Welcome to The Straight Dope, where you hear the real talk about Iowa Vice.
Hey, welcome back to The Straight Dope. I'm Colin Murphy. We're here today, as always, to talk about, provide the real unvarnished truth about issues with Vice in Iowa. And today, I'm glad to welcome Andrew Mertens, the Executive Director for the Iowa Association of Justice. Andrew, thank you for coming today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. You know, I've known you for a long time in your in your roles, various roles, including Executive Director for the Association. There are going to be some listeners that don't know what IAJ is or what IAJ does. Maybe you can give a couple minutes and tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, we are formerly known as the Iowa Trial Lawyers Association. And you can think of the Association for Justice a little bit like the State Bar Association. If you can easily imagine what the Iowa State Bar Association is, a membership representative organization of all lawyers, we're like a specialty bar association representing trial lawyers. And there are all kinds of trial lawyers, as you know. You can easily imagine trial lawyers that represent corporations or the government. Those aren't our members. Our members are those trial lawyers that represent real people going up against more powerful entities. So that is criminal defense lawyers, that's personal injury lawyers, that's workers' compensation lawyers that represent the injured worker, that is employment law attorneys, family law attorneys, you name it. But the sort of thread that that binds all of our members together is that they represent actual human beings going up against the more powerful entity.
And it's no surprise, you know, as long as I've been involved with IAJ, no surprise to me that when there are important issues, whether it's trial advocacy, legislative advocacy, the administration of justice in the state, whether civil or criminal, that where there is a controversy that warrants public discourse and input, that IAJ would be at the forefront of that. And that was the reason I had you on today, because one of the issues that is newsworthy is this betting scandal, the underage sports betting that was involving Iowa State and Iowa athletes and some professional athletes. And so I'd like to take some time, talk a little bit about that that controversy, what we discovered as a result of the discovery that was done in that, the kind of the timing of it, because there are some legislative issues that are pending that can impact how these issues get resolved in the future. And then obviously, while you're here, IAJ's response to that and why it was so important and newsworthy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there was an investigation that was started by the Division of Criminal Investigation here in the state that ended up targeting a number of athletes at Iowa State and Iowa. And, you know, from the reporting, what can you briefly tell us about that?
Well, there was about a little over a year ago, there was a number of arrests made of Iowa State and University of Iowa athletes accusing them of illegal gambling, illegal sports betting. And what we have discovered since then, now, a great number of those athletes pled guilty to what in reality are pretty minor charges.
Yeah, it's scheduled fines, like underage gambling.
Yes.
You know, it's a fine, no jail.
So when you consider underage gambling and then you consider sort of misuse of an account or fraudulent use of account, if you really step back to think about that crime, which is a pretty minor crime, it is in many ways akin to misuse of somebody's Netflix account.
Great analogy.
Borrowing somebody's Netflix account. And so a number of these arrests were made, and a number of these student athletes thankfully lawyered up.
Yes.
And through the process of building the defense for the charges that were put against them, the lawyers discovered that, in fact, the Department of Criminal Investigations for the state of Iowa did not get a warrant to do their initial search and surveillance of these student athletes at one of the athletic facilities in Ames and one of the athletic facilities in Iowa City. And ultimately, the charges for those four athletes were dropped. And it really opened up, I think, the conversation about what really went on here. And I think, you know, you had a large group of Iowans that follow college athletics.
Definitely.
That were already paying attention to this issue. And then you've got the rest of the state that their eyes were open to what happened here after the allegations of warrantless surveillance of, you know, young men, kids in the state of Iowa on our college campuses. And I think it really brought to light a lot of emotion on this. And I don't think we should be surprised at how much attention this issue has gotten in light of that.
No, I think you're right. And I should add that, you know, when Iowa rolled out sports betting, you know, one of the responsibilities that the state had was to make sure that we didn't have underage gamblers, you know, placing bets or going into casinos or having access to online apps and things like that. My understanding was when this investigation started, there wasn't any suspicion or reasonable suspicion that anyone was actually doing that.
Right.
And then they were able to leverage some technology to determine whether or not these sportsbook apps, you know, I won't bring the particular sportsbooks, you know, I won't name them, but companies that have online applications that you can access by cell phone, there's obviously an interest in the state of Iowa, the DCI, to make sure that there's no access to that. But they didn't really have any reports that there were athletes doing this or anything like that, to your knowledge.
You know, and the duty here is to make sure that people are placing bets in the state of Iowa.
Right.
And that's what the technology is for. You know, it's
great.
It's been brought up that in border cities, a Council Bluffs or a Davenport, it's important to know that the bets are placed legally, in that they're placed in Iowa. In what way is Ames and Iowa City a border city?
True.
That's one piece among many that's frustrating about this. The what we learned from the depositions that happen in these criminal cases is that the Department of Criminal Investigations did not get a warrant to search the athletic facilities in Ames and in Iowa City. What we've largely gathered is that prior to that, investigators were using this technology on dorm rooms.
Yes.
In Ames and in Iowa City. And I suspect as civil cases move forward, we will learn more about that. What I think naturally a lot of Iowans are curious about is where else has this technology been used that
Great.
We don't know about yet, whether in the context of gambling or not in the context of gambling. I think it puts a sharp point on why this issue has captured the attention of Iowa. I want to read a quote from the DPS commissioner, Steve Baines, that
So DPS, Department of Public Safety.
Mm-hmm. And he says, Steve Baines says, had this situation not involved college athletics, the public perception may have been entirely different. That's fair. And that is true to a point. And I can tell you that that my real interest in this as a citizen of Iowa, you know, honestly didn't begin until the revelations about the warrantless search came forward. And I think while a lot of interest may have started with the fact that it impacted college athletics that are so popular in this state, the real passions around this issue came forward after the warrantless search. Because I think depending on your age, if you are young enough, you can put yourself in the shoes of the college student.
Absolutely.
And you can think back to your own college days and think to yourself, I made some mistakes in college. A lot of people do. what I didn't expect is that the state was running surveillance on me to catch any potential mistake, large or small, that I could have made. If you're old enough, you can put yourself in the shoes of the parents because you worry about your own kids. You worry about the potential mistakes that your own kids could make. And the idea that the state would be running warrantless surveillance on your children is kind of terrifying.
And when you bring up warrantless surveillance, at least from the reporting, it sounds like they had geofenced or, you know, targeted specific, you know, physical locations. Initially, it was the dormitory. So they were looking to see if these apps were being opened within particular buildings where students were living. Obviously, that triggers some Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 8 Iowa constitutional protections because it involves a house or residence where people, you know, are domiciled. And then you have when law enforcement asked to expand that investigation based on what they found, my understanding was from the reporting that that authorization was not allowed, that they were denied access. But then when they turned their attention to geofence in the athletic facilities, where people may not have the same expectation of privacy as they do in the dorm, then if they find out information that these apps were being opened, then they were allowed to expand that. And the DCI appeared to claim that they had some sort of legal authority from maybe some experts or other attorneys. I'd love to see what that is.
No, I mean, I'm a little confused about that as well, because the statement that the Department of Public Safety put out in reaction to all this almost seems to indicate that the Attorney General's office didn't give them authority to do this search of,
because they would have said so.
They would have said, why wouldn't they have said so? They claim that they got legal advice that this was allowed. Whose specifically? I could imagine it was somebody within the department. I believe Steve Banz was a successful prosecutor in a former life himself. Maybe he relied on his own counsel, but we don't know yet. I imagine that type of information will come forward as civil lawsuits work their way through the process. But it is an open question on whose authority and legal advice was this relied on. It's I have no idea. I think a lot of people are curious about that.
You had mentioned that there was some the resolution of some of the cases maybe in Story County that were recently in the news, that charges were being dismissed as attorneys were filing pretrial motions challenging the admissibility of some of this evidence. And so with the dismissal in Story County, obviously it's done during the legislative session. Maybe if we can segue into what's going on in the legislature right now that is impacted by this event, the news surrounding these dismissals, things like that.
Sure. So what's so interesting about, I'd love to get a story from prosecutors in Story County behind the dismissal. You almost get the picture that they weren't told the whole story by law enforcement, and that as depositions brought more things to light, and as subpoenas were eventually approved by a judge, it became clear that there was a lot that they weren't told. The thing that regarding subpoenas that is incredibly fascinating to me, and again, I keep going back to, I think we're going to learn a lot more as civil cases work their way through. It almost appeared that the moment the subpoenas for more information from the department and subpoenas for more information about previous use of this geolocate surveillance technology was approved by a judge. It was initially not approved. It was deemed too broad. The lawyers came back with a more narrowed down request for subpoena power, which was approved. It seemed like the state decided at that point, we can't afford to tell the story behind what happened here. We better dismiss these cases right away.
Because so for the listeners that may not be familiar with the use of subpoenas, especially from the defense perspective, it's difficult for defense attorneys to get subpoenas for discovery in criminal cases.
And so I work for a lot of lawyers. I'm not a lawyer. I represent a lot of lawyers. But here's how I understand the process, and here's how I understand the history, that the use of investigatory subpoenas or defense subpoenas has effectively always existed. But there was a process a number of years ago, four years ago, where the judicial branch took a long overdue step of putting the process for seeking a subpoena power into the rules for criminal procedure. And so they put that existing process sort of into the rules. And the reaction from the state attorney general's office to the compromised nature of the way that those rules were put in place was to go lobby the legislature to effectively take the power away entirely. And so there are, in the rules currently, there are a number of hurdles that a criminal defense lawyer need to get past in order for a judge to even say, yes, you can go compel that evidence with a subpoena.
So difficult to get in the first place. And then what is this legislative effort geared at? What are they trying to do?
So this is how I would sort of describe it. The bill would make this already sort of substantial hurdle, in my mind, insurmountable, and in the minds of a lot of our members. The bill number, it's called House File 2616. So the criminal defense lawyer would have to prove. Right now, you basically have to demonstrate good faith evidence that the evidence would be exculpatory.
So it'd be favor the defendant, help the defendant.
It would help the defendant, broadly speaking. But the bill says that you would have to prove to a judge that the evidence that you're seeking is admissible and exculpatory before you even have the evidence. So it's impossible. The way I would describe it is a good faith belief that the evidence is exculpatory is in a way, it's similar to the requirement of law enforcement to show probable cause for a warrant. But requiring proof that the evidence is both admissible and exculpatory is akin to forcing law enforcement to prove that a crime was committed before you can investigate it.
And so we're taking an already difficult process for defense attorneys to get subpoenas that will help them defend. You know, it's part of it's a pretty well-balanced system as it exists right now. But the efforts through the legislature geared at kind of tilting that balance in favor of the state, taking away some abilities of defense attorneys to zealously represent their clients?
I think it's worse than that. Tilting is one way to put it. I think they're meant to eliminate the most powerful tools you have to independently investigate your client's case.
And tell us about who, you know, the efforts in the legislature. Who's spearheading that, or who are there some people that are more vocal than others?
Yes.
And do they have some unique role to play in this whole picture?
So there's two bills. The bill we just talked about, this defense subpoena bill, that takes away a defense lawyer's ability to subpoena evidence to properly investigate the case. That was put forward by the Attorney General's office. That was an AG bill pushed by the Attorney General's office. There's a second bill called Senate File 525 that would eliminate a defense lawyer's ability to use depositions to interview interested parties in the case. In the case that we're talking about here, in the gambling case, these depositions were used to interview DCI agents to discover that they didn't get a warrant. and to discover from another DCI agent that he was misled about who the target of the investigation was, and that he was asked to be removed from the investigation immediately upon discovering that because he strongly felt like there was a illegal search that happened, and he didn't want any part of it, and he wasn't alone. And so those things came forward in depositions. And so Senate File 525 effectively eliminates the ability of a criminal defense lawyer to do those types of depositions. Now, that bill wasn't put forward by the Attorney General's office. They certainly support it. That has been a pet project of a DCI agent who serves in the state Senate. His name's Senator Dan Dawson. And he's a active DCI agent from Council Bluffs who, my understanding is, has been involved in gambling investigations in previous roles as well.
So he works for the same agency that's, you know, leading the investigations into the underage gambling, and he's a proponent of a bill that would then restrict defense attorneys' ability to question the very DCI agents that are pursuing these investigations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And people should understand, of course, the vast majority of legislators have other jobs.
For sure.
They are basically part-time legislators, and most of them work in other roles. But he is an active DCI agent who is also actively working to strip criminal defense lawyers of their ability to independently investigate.
And you, obviously the press reaches out to you for comment. The comments that IAJ provided on this issue, I think that they're available for people to see.
Mm-hmm.
They've been, you know, maybe viral is not the right word to use, but like the amount of publicity that this has generated for the association on this important issue and these issues that are involved, privacy, technology, warrantless surveillance. I mean, it's been very eye-opening for a lot of people, and I think we have the association to thank for the comments and the public advocacy on this issue. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the reason that these posts have gotten so much attention is due to frustration with the posture of DCI through Senator Dawson. Some of the things that he has said on the Senate floor in reaction to this brewing controversy.
Yeah, maybe if you can.
For example, on January 24th, he said he was effectively defending the warrantless search. And he said, while yes, if I was going to run a case on, say, a homicide, and I wanted a geofence to see where someone was at, I would need a search warrant. But this chamber should also realize that we are talking about gaming things here in the state. This is an entirely different ball game. Gaming is a vice, like alcohol, like tobacco. And for those vices, we have special regulatory authority here in this state. I think a lot of people can appreciate how troubling of a statement that is. The idea that your right to privacy takes a backseat and the Constitution takes a backseat because you're accused of gambling or tobacco use or alcohol use. That was one statement that he made. And then later in March, he got up again defending his department and said that his fellow senators need to understand and appreciate that this investigation led to 18 guilty pleas, as if that justifies an unconstitutional search. The idea that the ends justify the means here is frustrating to hear. And I think people want our elected officials to have a different posture when it comes to mistakes made by the government. I think there's an expectation that our elected officials would seek answers here rather than seek legislative proposals that will allow the state to cover up future misdeeds like this.
That's a great point. you know, if people wanted to learn more about IAJ or follow IAJ on social media, where can they find you and the association?
So they can find us at Accountable, or they can find us at the Iowa Association for Justice at iowajustice.org. And we also have a grassroots advocacy arm of the association that we call Accountable Iowa. And you can find us on Facebook at accountableiowa.org and facebook.org/accountableiowa.
I appreciate that. Well, Andrew, we're coming to an end. I know that there's going to be more on this topic, and so we look forward to having you back to discuss that. But again, thank you very much for your appearance today on Straight Dope.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.